Hi.
Hi. So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode number 92, Genderqueer, a Memoir, by Maya Kobabe, and Colors by Phoebe Kobabe.
Hello, my name is Maya Kobabe. I'm the author of Genderqueer, a Memoir, one of the most banned books in America. I wrote this book because I was wanting to come out as non-binary to my friends and family and community, and I was having a really hard time explaining what gender means to me in conversation, and in particular to my parents. And in many ways, I wrote this book as a letter to my parents and my extended family, hoping that they would finally understand what I was trying to say and really know me on a deeper level. There were a couple of books that inspired me, Fun Home by Alison Bechdel being one of them, but I also wrote this book because I couldn't find a book like this to give to my family. I spent my teen years like searching for queer stories. What I found was crumbs, side characters, tiny little side plots, one-off episodes in TV shows. But I think if I'd been able to find a book like Genderqueer as a teenager, it would have meant the world to me. It would have become my favorite book. I would have been obsessed with it. I would have made everyone read it. I would have probably read a copy of it until it fell to pieces. I was just so desperate to figure out who I was and to find answers to the questions that I had, and I really couldn't find them until I was much older. I have come to have many identities throughout my life. I identify as queer and bi and non-binary and as being on the ace and aero spectrum. And this book is partly about trying to figure out where does sort of my gender identity intersect with my sexuality? And it's a tricky question. They're very interwoven. It is a memoir. It's about my life. I'm the only one who has lived it. No one has had the same sort of set of circumstances that I have. But one thing I think is actually unique is that it's a story of queerness and coming out in a very accepting and loving family and a very accepting and loving part of the country. And I actually faced very little external pressures in my life, and all of my sort of conflict was very internal. And a lot of queer stories have dealt with a lot more external struggle than mine, and I think those stories are really important. But I think we need all kinds of stories, so we also need the ones where someone is able to grow and come out very gently in a very safe environment. There are so many kinds of people in this world, and everyone needs a different kind of story. And stories can serve multiple purposes. They can be mirrors in which you see yourself. They can be windows in which you can see a view into another person's lived experience. And even if a book does not seem useful or valuable to one reader, it might be deeply valuable to another. And that's why we need lots of types of books and lots of types of stories. And I don't think my book is for everyone, but I think for the people who need it, it could be a lifeline. I am very against censorship, and I think all books need to stay on the shelves because readers need all kinds of stories. There was almost no negative reaction to the book for the first 2.5 years that it was out. The negative responses didn't really come until the run-up to the 2021 fall midterm election. I was not shocked because I'm definitely aware that queer and trans and non-binary stories often get challenged, but the timing of it surprised me until I realized that multiple politicians were making it a real talking point. I think it's been surprising to me how long book challenges and book bans have stayed present as like a conversation in the media. I'm used to things going viral and sort of fading out of attention more quickly, but we're now heading into like the second full year of Genderqueer being one of the most challenged books. The first thing I would say is please read it before you judge it. I started questioning gender and sexuality basically when I hit puberty, when I was like 11, 12, 13 years old. And I was asking these questions by the time I was in high school, and I was searching for this type of information. If I'd had a book to read like this, specifically when I was like a freshman in high school, it would have saved me years of questioning and confusion about my identity. I have had so many beautiful, like, heartwarming responses, the kind of responses that an author, like, lives on. I've had people tell me the book helped them understand themselves better, the book gave them language that they'd never had before to explain their identity. I've had younger people tell me that they gave it to their parents, and now their parents, like, use their pronouns. It has opened conversations they never had before.
How does that feel?
It's wonderful. That's exactly what you want when you write a book like this. I am excited to be working on my second book. It's fictional, but it explores a lot of the same themes of genderqueer, of sexuality, identity, trying to find yourself, but more in the junior high range. And I'm very excited to be working on it with a co-author, Lucky Sreekumar, and it is due out from Scholastic Graphics in 2025.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast brought to you by Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature and sometimes graphic novels. And each month we take a thorough look at one particular piece of literature that we've both read and one of us has chosen to lead us through, and we determine whether it is in fact required reading. So I am here, Stella, your guide. And with me is, actually, this is interesting because even though I'm leading us through this discussion, this was really new for me. And I think this is similar for Tom, kind of the discussion of gender in this way. And so I'm really interested to talk about this, and I really enjoyed reading this. So yeah, I really don't want to be seen as like an expert on gender identities, but I am helping guide through this particular work, and Tom is right here as my trusty co-pilot, like always.
Oh, thank you. I try.
Oh, yes. Well, we're recording during Pride Month, but this will come out later, but it is apropos of when we're recording, at least. And it's the last required reading that we are recording in my Charlottesville apartment.
Well, I'm in my Charlottesville house. We've never actually recorded an episode of this live together, to my knowledge. But yes, this is the last time the two of us are going to be in the same geographical area.
Yeah.
And recording a podcast like this. So it's bittersweet.
Oh, Tom. I think, did we do an episode live at Starbucks at one point? No, we did do that one special after we hiked.
Yes. Okay. So it's the we've done one. Yeah. Because we've done episodes of my show at Starbucks and over breakfast at the Villa. Yeah. But we did the one where we went on the hike.
Yes.
And we spotted at least, I think it was one corgi.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah.
Whose butts are buoyant.
Yes.
If you didn't know.
Yeah. Corgis float.
Oh boy. It has been a wild ride. And I wonder if we would have started this podcast if we had not been in the same locale, because I remember us meeting up to hash out, like, we both kind of had this idea and talked about it, like, lightly, I think. And then I think it was really you who thought, you know, it's possible. Let's think about it.
Yeah.
And then we met up at Starbucks. This does seem to be our thing. And we branch out people sometimes. And you had like notes and things. And like, I think we should start with Of Mice and Men, and kind of thought about, you know, what will the identity of our podcast be and kind of the culture of it and things like that. Do you feel like it worked out best because we were in the same vicinity and we could have that face-to-face and really be serious and talk through these important points? Or, I don't know, do you think it would not have happened had we not been in the same location?
I think it really, really helped. I don't know if it would have – this is going to sound weird. I think it lasted and has been as good as it has been because we've been in the same location.
Mm.
So I think theoretically we could have hashed it out over emails and messages and Skype calls and stuff like that. It was fun to do it in person. And then the fact that we've become very good friends over the years, I think has – just made it even better, because we haven't really done much to change the format of the show. We've tweaked little things here and there, but it's very similar to what it was when, like, it started. So I think we had something that was really good from the get-go. So, and I think it's just gotten better.
Oh, Tom. Such good times. And as I've said, I think, as you said, yeah, we became good friends. I think we had a good foundation because I think when you have I've said this like multiple times, but it's true that when you have a podcast with a co-host, there really has to be trust in that, you know, trust that they're prepared, trust that if you're alternating editing that, you know, that sort of thing is going to get done. And I think we had that. And I totally agree that I feel like maybe we were like more acquaintances, like strong acquaintances when we first started and, you know, we're hanging out. But like I count you as one of my closest friends, to be honest.
Aww,
and I think
me
that
too.
Just really paved the way. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it's not over. It makes it sound like we're never doing this again.
It's not the last episode, no.
But no, I just was getting the feels because it's like, oh, yeah, I'm leaving. But not too far away, so.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're doing... I mean, I was going to say, like, is it uplifting? I think it, man, this does go through all the feels, I think, and ups and downs and all sorts of, yeah, things to contemplate. And I'm excited to dive into it.
It's not a tragedy on anyone.
No, no. But certainly there are, like, moments I really felt her anxiety and kind of her hurt feelings over certain things and also her joy at discovering these new pronouns and things like that. So you definitely feel – you run through the gamut of feelings, I think. So, yes, we are doing Genderqueer. And I know a little bit about your history just because I knew that you had read it before. But for the sake of our audience members who might just be listening because of this episode and this particular work – what is your history with this graphic novel?
Oh, it's not a particularly exciting history or anything like that. I spotted it at my high school library last spring, and I knew that it was, at that point, I think it was either the number one or number two banned book in the country. It was like a big favorite target of Ku Klux Karen. So, you know, I was like, well, I've heard so much about this book. Let me go ahead and check it out and read it. And then so this is my second time reading it.
And I feel like I knew a lot about it from you and from our discussions of challenging, which frequently comes up in our podcast. And of course, we had the special dedicated to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested, it seemed like spiritually somewhat connected to Fun Home, and Kobabe actually mentions there's actually a panel from Fun Home.
Yeah, she references it.
Yeah. And so I felt like, oh man, it's kind of, you know, kind of the time. And I was waiting because I remember you told me like what the explicit panel is that everyone points to. And I'm like waiting for it because Fun Home, I think, you know, just a refresher. I read that at the gym and was unsure. I did not know that what was about to happen. I was like, uh-oh. And I was reading today in my work cubby because I didn't have any sub assignments. And I got to that panel, and luckily I was by myself, but I did have to, like, close it because someone, like, just came in, and I had to wait until they left and then opened it back up again. But, yeah, so my experience is mainly through your experience, and this is the first time that I read it, and I think you told me it's a quick read, and I saw online, you know, that it's very much something that you can sit down and digest in one sitting. And I would agree that you can, like, read it through, but it's also something that I think warrants multiple read-throughs because there are, like, many panels that I was, like, really kind of contemplating, you know, what this meant. Mm-hmm. So it's a really deep graphic novel, in my opinion, even though, like, it might look like it's not, you know, if you open up, you know, the art.
Yeah, it's a little more dense than it lets on. I think I finished in like two or three sittings only for time's sake. But it is a good you can reread it, but you can also flip through it and reread certain parts very easily, which is not the case with every graphic novel. So you can go to certain things she references or certain things scenes she shows us and things like that. And read that excerpt section or forward from there or whatever you want to do. You don't have to reread the whole thing to keep getting the whole thing.
Absolutely. And I will say that Tom, I'm going to make an example of him, but this is a good time to do it. So Tom used the wrong pronouns. But this is, I think that this might happen to us just as we get to know and use those. I actually have never used the E, air, M.
No, neither have I.
And so this happens in Air Book. And we'll just keep on going, yeah. And know for listeners that we are definitely, like, we're willing to, you know, learn and to practice and get it done. And I think it's almost like, well, it's definitely, we're definitely the people in there that Kobabe was meeting and trying to work through it and get to know it. I don't know that, you know, I think it will not happen, like, frequently. But, you know, I think we'll just, if it happens, we'll correct and then we'll move on. So I looked up those, because that, I, like, never understood those particular pronouns. And then I looked them up because I'm like, okay, we're going to be doing this. Mm-hmm. And it clicked. It was, like, very easy because it's basically just taking off, you know, the first letter from, like, the female identifying and male identifying pronouns. It was like, that totally makes sense. So E with an E would be like she and he, using it in that same case. And then M-E-M be like him or her, so the direct object or objective cases. And then air is E-I-R, and that's more like the possessive, so we'd say like their or her.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah.
Hers or his.
Yes. So yeah. So there you go.
You know, actually, this book is the whole reason I know these types of pronouns exist.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah, I'd never heard of them before I read this, so I was like, okay.
I had, man, like years ago, and of course it was like not accepted. Everyone's like, what is this? And so luckily now we're at a better stage in our lives, but people are still pushing back. Okay, so we'll talk about the context, you know, the book and the author. I won't get too much into the author. It's more, I think, air writing history and significance that way, because the memoir is a funny thing, because why would we talk about the author's background when we're going to be delving into it? So that's kind of what I'll be doing there. And I got this from Wikipedia. So Kobabe graduated with an MFA in comics from California College of the Arts. Kobabe's work features themes of identity, sexuality, anti-fascism, which I'm interested in that, fairy tales, and homesickness. Kobabe's graphic nonfiction work has been featured in The Nib, Press Democrat, and SF Weekly, among other publications. Kobabe's first full-length book, Genderqueer, a memoir, was published by Lionforge Comics in 2019. When asked in Time Magazine interview why he wrote the book, Kobabe said, "I wrote this book in huge part because I was struggling to come out, and I was asking myself all these questions, and I was having these somewhat challenging conversations. And it often seems like I was never able to fully get my point across. And I got to the point where I thought, I have to sit down and write about this because I don't feel like I'm getting across verbally what I'm really trying to say." End quote. And that's really interesting also when we think about at the very beginning, and there is, I think, a moment in the middle where E was not about writing memoirs or autobiographies, was very mm-hmm. against it. And so I think, yeah, E just got to a point where put up or shut up, maybe.
Yeah. Like,
you just got to get this out here. Genderqueer was made available in some school libraries, but was subsequently banned by a school district in Alaska due to its sexually explicit content. Kobabe responded to the controversy with an opinion piece in the Washington Post, suggesting that accusers were upset less by the sexually explicit images and language than by the LGBTQ themes of the book. Genderqueer was listed as one of the most banned or challenged books in September 2021, as we've discussed, by the American Library Association's Office of Intellectual Freedom. According to a report in September 2022 from PEN America, Kobabe was the second most banned author in U.S. school districts during the 2021 and 2022 school year, with Genderqueer the most frequently challenged book, banned in 41 school districts. Discussing a wave of book censorship in early 2022 within the United States, in a Slate interview, Kobabe said, "What I'm learning is that a book challenge is like a community attacking itself. The people who are hurt in a challenge are the marginalized readers in the community where the challenge takes place. That is readers who are younger, readers who do not have the financial means to buy books if they're not available for free in the library. That is queer teens who might not feel comfortable bringing a book with such an obvious title into their home. If they have more conservative parents who would only feel safe reading the book secretly in the library without even checking it out. So yes, it upsets me because what I'm seeing is resources being taken away from queer marginalized youth, which does hurt. That does hurt me. In January 2023, Scholastic acquired Saatchi's Stories by Kobabe and Lucky Shrikumar in a six-figure auction. A middle-grade graphic novel is scheduled for publication by Scholastic's imprint, Graphics, in 2025. So, still working. I found it, well, in the memoir, Kobabe was at Comic-Con when I was at Comic-Con, but I would not have known of him, so... I can't help you there. Just a couple, let's see, receptions, critical receptions. Publishers Weekly, in that review, stated that this heartfelt graphic memoir relates with sometimes painful honesty the experience of growing up non-gender conforming. Tegan O'Neill for the Comics Journal commented that more than simply a memoir, the book is designed to explain the very concept of being non-binary, beginning with the author's first memories of gender and ending with the discovery of Spivak pronouns. Jenny Frencham for the School Library Journal called the graphic novel a great resource for those who identify as non-binary or asexual, as well as for those who know someone who identifies that way and wish to understand better. Jacob Roden for the News Gazette said that due to the format, the book is easily digestible, as I said, in a single setting, and Kobabe holds the reader's hand every step of the way into the weeds of gender construction. And then finally, Sophie Brown for Geek Mom commented that Genderqueer isn't an especially easy book to read, but it is a powerful one. And Genderqueer in 2020 was one of the 10 books to receive an Alex Award from the American Library Association for books written for adults that have special appeal to young adults ages 12 through 18. And in that same year, the book was also a finalist for the Stonewall Book Award for nonfiction. Anything else you would like to add?
Not that I can think of as far as the background. Ellen Hopkins was the most banned author that year, by the way.
Oh, what did that person write?
This is a good question. I have no idea. Okay, that's okay. I just Googled most banned author. Let me, Crank.
Oh.
That series of books. So okay. I guess she was the most banned author because several of her books were banned, whereas Kobabe's got the one, right? So.
Yeah.
So yeah, there you go. No, I like I said, I heard about this. It's one that, like, when the fascists want to roll out their censorship reel, they throw up a couple of the panels from this and scream pornography. And this is attached to their whole groomers argument and all
groomers?
This.
Groomers. Oh, because. Like trying to use a book to turn someone gay.
Yeah, the whole idea that it's their whole the turn to be or that we're their argument is that schools and teachers are grooming them because we're all pedophiles or some crap. I don't know. So I really don't want to go down this road, but we'll talk about the censorship a little bit later after I guess when we get into our discussion of the book. But I know we're not gonna. I'd rather spend. The vast majority of the discussion on the book itself and not the controversy surrounding it, because the controversy surrounding it is made up.
Sure. Yeah. And I'd like to talk about in particular the two panels that's really called into question.
Sure.
So yes.
We'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Yep, absolutely. Well then let's get into the plot synopsis, which I think also came from the Wikipedia, if I'm not incorrect. Okay. So here we go. The memoir begins with a brief introduction in which Kobabe writes of attending graduate school for art and taking an autobiography class. The teacher suggested the students write about their biggest secrets. Kobabe wrote about air gender identity, but taped paper over those papers in air sketchbook because E was embarrassed. Kobabe then begins with air childhood. E grew up in Northern California with hippie parents, a younger sister, and a neighbor best friend named Galen. When Galen and Kobabe started kindergarten, E had air first experiences with gender roles and expectations, as these kinds of beliefs were not reinforced in air home. E recalls being excluded from a clubhouse because E was a girl and being asked to put Air's shirt back on at a school field trip to the beach. At age 11, Kobe began menstruating. E found this to be an upsetting experience, and E still has nightmares about it. E began wearing a bra and wished E would develop breast cancer so E would have to get a mastectomy. By high school, Kobe realized E might be queer. E was attracted in particular to a masculine-looking girl in Air class, but also fantasized about sex between two men. The Yowie. The only openly gay student at Air School, David, started a queer straight alliance club, and Kobe joined, feeling pleased to meet other students who were queer and or allies. E was uncertain as to how to define Air sexuality because E was also confused about Air gender identity. E wondered if E was a lesbian or perhaps, quote, a gay boy trapped in a girl's body, end quote. In her journal entry from this period, E wrote, quote, I don't want to be a girl, I don't want to be a boy either, I just want to be myself, end quote. At age 16, Kobabe had Air hair cut short in a salon. E did not like the feminine style the hairdresser gave him. It was like an A-line bob, I think it was. So E had Air's sister Phoebe cut it differently. Phoebe is also queer and has long been supportive of Kobabe's sexuality and gender identity. Just before high school graduation, Kobabe was asked out on a date by a male classmate. That was a manipulative scene, I have to say. Because that guy said one date and only one date, then called his girlfriend and hung up. And that was nuts. But anyways, E agreed, but then backed out after the boy referred to M as his girlfriend. E recalls thinking, quote, I will never be anyone's girlfriend, end quote. E came out to Air mother as bisexual, and she was supportive. Kobe went to art school for Air undergraduate degree and got a job at the school library. One day, a female classmate named Autumn came into the library, and one of Kobe's coworkers told M that she had a crush on M. Embarrassed, Kobe fled, but later contacted the girl on Facebook. He considered dating the girl just to understand what dating was like, but ultimately decided not to. On pages 121, Kobe has drawn a scale, which E uses as a metaphor for Air gender identity. One side is weighed down with a large weight reading assigned female at birth, while Kobe is adding weights to the other side reading short hair and baggy boy clothes. E does not want to appear more masculine, only to appear less feminine to balance the scale after being assigned female at birth. While getting Air first gynecological pap smear exam, Kobe experienced extreme physical and psychological pain, gender dysphoria related to being reminded of Air assigned at birth gender. E told Air mother that E was genderqueer, and she was supportive but confused, telling Kobe, quote, you don't have to be super feminine to be a woman, end quote. She did not understand that Kobe did not identify as a woman at all. Kobe started graduate school and began writing fan fiction about the boy band One Direction. He wanted some dating experience to write more realistic stories. And that was my favorite quote of the whole thing, because he said that he needed to date for research. It reminded me of Donovan always saying, for science? So E downloaded a dating app and met a woman named Z, whom E dated and had Air first sexual experiences with. E broke up with Z upon realizing that E needed to better understand Air gender before having a romantic relationship. Kobe met an old family friend named Jana B, who told him that E was non-binary and using the Spivak pronouns E-M Air. Kobe liked these pronouns, like really felt great about them, and decided to start using them himself. E told Air family and friends about Air new pronouns, and people were very receptive, though they made mistakes. E suffered through, another gynecological exam, this time telling the doctor beforehand about Air gender dysphoria. The doctor prescribed anxiety and pain medication to help Kobe through the experience, but let me just say that E had to go through the first experience to get the drugs and then had to come back again. Kobe began teaching a class on comics to junior high students. E was uncertain if E should tell them that E was non-binary, but ultimately decided to do so. Since E did not know any non-binary people growing up, E understood the importance of being a figure of representation to a younger generation. And that is where the memoir ends. So, of course, the first question is, did you like this?
I did. There's something I can't put my finger on about it, though. And this has been bugging me ever since I read it last year. Because I can't give this 5 stars. It'd be like 4, but I can't tell you why it would be 4 stars instead of 5.
Sure.
Maybe it's because it's just very, very episodic. I think there are things that are missing. Yeah. If I'm being completely honest, there's not much of an ending. There's a lot of things that are left unresolved, but then again, it is a memoir, so I'm not expecting like of everything to be wrapped up in a package.
Mm-hmm.
And I fear criticizing this book because of the content and because of who I am.
Sure. I get that. I don't know that I would say content-wise it's what, but more how it is written. I think that you're probably
critiquing. Yes, it has nothing to do with like what she is presenting to us as far as gender and sexuality. So the stuff was fascinating. Some of it I didn't even know. Right. There's things I learned. It was how it was written. So it's on the literary storytelling point of view. That's where I'm like, there's something missing, and there's something, but I couldn't exactly put my finger on it. And like I said, I'm hesitant to be critical because I don't want to come off as insensitive or intolerant.
Sure. No, I would agree that at times it did not have a flow about it, like a narrative flow, because we would be on track with something and then there would be like a memory from another time or an anecdote about another person. And there were also, I do have two specific critiques. Two points, E used some abbreviations that were not footnoted what they were, and I had to think what they were. One of them was, well, first of all, I don't think I had ever seen LGBTQIA2S. Was that in there?
I saw it in your notes. I think it is. And
I had no idea what 2S was, so I had to look that up. It means two spirit.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was AAB or something. And then I was looking at it. I'm like, oh, it's assigned at birth.
Okay. Yeah. I've always seen it as AFAB. A female assigned as birth or something to do. The usual F or M is... Mm-hmm. Is what I usually see in terms of that abbreviation too.
Yeah, I think you can't assume necessarily that a reader would know that, especially if we're using this for educational purposes.
Yeah.
We'll get to like for whom is this intended. And I also think just like academically, you know, when you're writing papers and things like that, the first time you use something, you have to like spell it out. Like Esau, you couldn't just put Esau. You'd have to say what that means. And then the rest of the time you say like, from now on, I'll say it.
Yeah, so dude, I mean, comic books have had little asterisks with boxes, like explaining things like MO,
yes.
you know, like modus operandi, right? And and things like that for decades. So yeah, I think a little footnote would have been that all you need, a little asterisk with a footnote.
Yeah. And I think I just lost track of some characters, especially Aaron's best friend, which came up in some things as if like something had happened, which he does talk about that something.
Yeah.
Lost. Yeah. But there are just other like moments I'm like, I'm not sure I'm fully understanding what's happening here.
Mm-hmm.
So I would agree with you. I mean, I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot and I took my time reading it and considered and contemplated a lot of things. But yeah, I would agree that it might have been missing a flow at times.
It's like he didn't know what he wanted the book to be. Is it a TED Talk? And a lecture and an educational seminar about gender identity with personal anecdotes tied in so that you can identify with or see something on a more, because, you know, we can relate to it, or you can see something that's more personal, less clinical. It does kind of hit home a little bit. Or is it air biography?
Yeah.
It's both. And I don't think that a weave them both together in a way that is 100% effective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so let's get into it. So, of course, Maya talks about her first memories of gender from early to late childhood. And I wondered, number one, I guess, you know, what are your thoughts about each of these depictions? But when was the first time you realized you were a man?
That's a trap question, Stella. I'm not kidding. That's the, because I just was, and that's where that's the thing. Of course you did. You're cisgender. I mean, that's a trap question.
Okay.
Yeah. Because it just was like, there was no concept of gender in my childhood beyond, you know, male and female. So, I mean, then, you know, and you learn, you know, and so there was nothing beyond that, you know, it just kind of was there.
I will say, even though you say it's a trap question, that I felt a kindred spirit with Maya because I also got told to put my shirt back on because I'm very much a tomboy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, to a certain extent, like, you're able to, and then you get to a point where you're like, nope, now you got to put your shirt back on. So, yeah, I remember wanting to swim without my shirt, wanting to wrestle without my, and I was like, my parents, I guess, just they put it back on. And I didn't understand, you know, I was like, what's the big deal, Leo, you know? So I felt, really resonated with that particular scene. I mean, how do you, this is like, what are Maya's feelings? I mean, we're reading it, but what do you think about, is it clear what her feelings are in each of these depictions?
I think her feeling is confusion more than anything. In these moments, because she doesn't know, and that does track with the rest of the book because it's something she struggles with her entire life. So that initial feeling of confusion, now for some might come off as, I just didn't understand what a boy and a girl, et cetera, et cetera. Or in her case, sorry, Air case, it was the start of something that would become a much deeper exploration as they got, you know, matured.
Yeah.
You know, because at 4, 5, 6 years old, you're not thinking about, you're really not thinking about these things, right? And mm-hmm. you are just like, somebody tells you, put a shirt on, and you are kind of like, why? You know, Timmy has his shirt off.
Mm-hmm.
And unless it has been ingrained in you since you first kind of were more cognizant of how you were dressing, like if mommy was putting you in dresses, and mom and dad took you to, or your parents, sorry, took you to, I don't know, the kiddie pool, and you were always in a little toddler one piece or something, then if you were like that, then it was already ingrained in you and imprinted upon you that this is how you're supposed to dress when you're out in public, and this is what you're not supposed to take off, and this is what you used to keep on. But if A never had that and A were allowed to just kind of be free, then the confusion is very real. In this case, it does lead to, it's not the cause of anything. It's just what kind of the first step along what would become this sort of existential exploration.
Yeah. And the fact that that one time or the one episode where Maya was told to put airship back on at the beach.
Yeah.
And then Maya asked why. And the teacher does not give an answer. It's just like, you just need to put it back on. And that's not helpful either, because it's always good to have an explanation as to why, you know, that's happening. And I feel like that also pushed kind of this gender confusion too, because if you have a question, someone's like unable to answer it, then you're just gonna spiral and like try to, it's gonna take longer for you to figure it out, I would say.
Yeah.
So
I also want to say that one of the reasons that her teacher, air teacher, reacts like that is that in the 2 or 3 pages before that, Maya goes to school for the first time at a Waldorf school. And like every other panel is, I don't know how to do this. So that might be the teacher being like, this again, and being frustrated because what else does Maya not know?
Yeah.
And so that might not even be I'm enforcing, it's the sort of like, how do you not know this? Mm-hmm. Which is not, you know, it's not the most positive reaction to something and stuff. And I also think it's like, do I really want to get into this huge discussion with this child in this public place? I just need them. I need her from the perspective of the teacher there. I'm not misgendering her on purpose, to get the shirt on, you know? So yeah. I think that's also that too.
Yeah. What techniques does Kobabe use as an author to help us get to know the many characters in Maya's life throughout her life, such as heir family and friends? And which characters do you most relate to, and which characters do you least relate to?
She introduces her parents like in full profile, right? Like, here's my mom, here's my dad, here's Phoebe. At various points, we just meet some of the other characters, like the friends and stuff, as they meet them. And depending on the impact on their life, we get a little bit of information or quite a bit of information. But I think with you, you earlier said, like, some of the characters just kind of, like, come and go.
Mm-hmm.
So they're only so developed. They're almost like sketches of people. So it is hard to kind of attach yourself to one character who isn't Maya, which, I mean, people flit in and out of your life all the time. So that's part of it. I mean, it's not unrealistic. Honestly, again, kind of at your question here, I don't relate to any of the characters, but that's kind of the point.
Sure.
You know, I mean, you know, this is if I'm looking at it from the point of view of somebody who is not the person, like the complete opposite of the person in the book, so to speak, or very much different than the person in the book, then this is a window. And I don't relate to really any of her family, but I personally don't feel that it's a requirement to relate to a character in order to enjoy a novel or a book to be good. So I can just indulge my curiosity and explore these characters without feeling that I have to identify with them.
You don't think you identify with that college guy who was complaining about cisgender being a thing?
You know, at one point I did feel that because of the way he said, because the conversation was very real and the frustration he was expressing was very real. Page 145. Yeah. So not long after this, I had a conversation about the word cisgender with a cis straight male friend from high school. He says, I feel like this word just came out of nowhere. I'd never seen it before a month ago. Now it's in all these online spaces. And if you don't know what it means, people call you an asshole. And then he says, it's not hard to look up the meaning of a word. Google it. And he replies, yeah, but like, well, do you identify as cisgender? And he says, you know, not really, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on to another topic. But it is I think this is a very real thought from a lot of people who, you know, you can even say, like, when did this term come up? And somebody say, it's been around for years and years. And it's just like, but it really has only entered the lexicon in the last, what, decade? If that. And I've got to be honest, most of the time I see it used in the pejorative. So I don't get my underwear in a knot about it anyway. But I do understand where he's coming from in that conversation, because he's expressing a concern and getting dismissed with the, well, I shouldn't have to teach you to go Google it yourself sort of way. And it's just like, I don't think that's the point he's making.
Yeah. I would agree with you that you don't need to relate to a character in order to enjoy the work. I mean, to a certain extent, again, I said I was a tomboy growing up, and I would probably prefer as a child. I mean, even now, you know, if there's a superhero shirt that the men's have that the women's don't, then I'm going to go for it and I don't care. So there are definitely moments that I related to Maya. I think Maya does a good job as an author in separating who's important and who's not, if only because even though the college students get kind of muddled, or I should say college friends, it's clear that the conversation is more important than the person, perhaps. So it could be really anyone. When he wanted to focus in on a person for their identity, for a particular reason, then that was made very clear that mm-hmm. oh, you should be attentive to this particular person.
That's true.
I would say Maya lucked out with Air family
mm-hmm.
because they're like very open and accepting and loving, and this is not everyone's story, so I was happy to have that there, because this could have been a tragic graphic novel. And but the one interesting character that I found, I was like, oh, we're gonna get to this, aren't we, is that aunt, I think it was, where they're playing Settlers of Catan.
Yeah.
Like the closest cousin that E had, and then an aunt. And the aunt is like a lesbian feminist, I think, were the epithets connected to
yes.
her. And she basically said that this sort of gender identity, or like questioning it, is a form of misogyny.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really interesting conversation. I wish there would have been more pages dedicated to that, because I think that that is consistently an argument. I mean, this is where the TERFs are coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And like trans athletes, if people are feminists, they're not necessarily for them because they feel like this is misogyny. Like, we fought for rights. What are you doing now? But the conversation went until 1 a.m. and we lose a lot of that. And Maya kind of struggles and even says, I don't know how to explain or answer that question, but it's not. And then even wrestled with that, like, oh my gosh, is it internalized misogyny? Like, what's going on? So that was really intriguing. I think a lost opportunity to go deeper into that, because like I said, that's something that is constantly being brought up now. Especially with Title IX and sports and things like that. But yeah, so what do you think about Air family overall and that acceptance and love? And then do you have any thoughts on that? I think it was an aunt.
Yeah, it's an aunt. Okay. I believe so. Because actually I'm open to the page. It okay. is Aunt Sherry. It came okay. out as a lesbian feminist before I was born. But Aunt Sherry comes around at the end of the scene. Yes. And we have to make yeah. sure that people know that. This is yeah. not... This is a person who is just not used to who has been, you know, living as an open out as an open gay woman for many, many years. But the idea of gender identity is fairly new to her. Yeah. So it's not her feelings in my mind are not coming from a place of hatred. They are coming from a place of, in some cases, ignorance. And yes, a little bit of concern or worry. It does border. It is interesting to see the TERF opinion, but I'm with you. Like, where's the rest of this conversation?
Yeah.
And that was a huge criticism I had of that scene, because that would have been really interesting to see. We talked for hours. Like, you could have like kind of done a time lapse montage, right? Of different things we made and different things we saw. And it's just, oh, we talked until 1 a.m. It's just like, you're going to kind of leave it hanging there, because you struggled to respond to her in the first place, but by the end of the night, she turns to you and refers to you as E. How did you get there?
Mm, yeah.
Because what Air Aunt says is, your happiness is very important to me, but I have a hard time seeing this trend of FTM, trans and genderqueer young people, as something other than a kind of misogyny. That's a pretty powerful thing to say.
Yeah.
Like, in a very negative way. Like, so how do we get to within 1, 2, 3? Now she says, well, I know you're a grown woman, be careful. I mean, you are a grown up person. Sorry.
Yeah.
Like, in 1, 2, 3, 4 panels, like, there needs to be more there. Cause I would have loved to see that conversation, or at least parts of it, because I'm like, how did she get there? But yeah, I think the family, it's wonderful that the family is so open-minded and so supportive. But I actually worry that a kid who is reading this and is identifying with Maya, but is really closeted because of their family, is going to worry even more. Because they cannot relate to the experience of people who are supportive. Like,
yeah.
Like they're, it's going to, it might compound some of the shame or feelings and things like that.
Yeah. This is obviously real life, because sometimes, you know, when reading fiction, because of course, you know, I dabble in all sorts of romances.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's like a hard coming out story, and sometimes it's easy. And, you know, I look at comments sometimes and I'm like, you know, it's nice to have like a not traumatic coming out experience.
True.
And that's what I was thinking reading this. Again, it's real life, but just like, I'm so glad that everything was for the most part, you know, like it could have been way worse.
Oh, yeah.
But do you think it's like the hippie?
I think it is the hippie thing.
Okay.
On some level, too, because her parents were very open-minded. But at the same time, it could have also seen, I don't know, there's that weird irony with hippies who were just, like, closed-minded about a certain thing. So it wasn't surprising that they were supportive. But, like, I wouldn't have been surprised if they turned around and were just, like, weirdly hypocritical about this. Mm-hmm. Kind of like how the aunt was, but the parents were fairly supportive.
Okay, well, we will move on from that. So, yeah, just talking about books, as I did, obviously gay and queer media have some sort of influence mm-hmm. on Maya's life. We see artists, movies, TV shows, and books that are listed between pages 72 and 75. Were you previously familiar with any of the ones that E mentioned? And then do you feel like, I mean, in your time growing up, can you think of many queer and obviously we're in a completely different time, I think, now than we were back in the 90s and before that. But what are some examples of, I was just talking to Donovan and I said, you know, Kate Kane was the first lesbian that I saw in a comic book in 52. And that was what, 2005, 2006?
Yeah.
So just like, so it's ironic that I just told him that today. So take that as you, any of those questions, I guess.
I picked off through, I was going through I went with the pages where they were explicitly talking about queer media, because there was a page like 72 has a bunch of just like fantasy stuff on it. It's like, yeah, who hasn't heard of the Lord of the Rings at this point? But there were three books, two of which I've read, one of which I've heard of. The one I've heard of was Will Grayson, which I actually mentioned last class, because I believe last episode. Like,
what?
Because it was David Levithan and John Green, I think, co-wrote it. I think I mentioned in Green's bio. I haven't read that one. But the two that I have read, one is The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Oh, yes.
Which came out in 97, 98. We should do that at some point. And the other
about trauma.
Yeah. And then the other one that I read, actually own a copy of, is Pedro and Me, because it's written, if you're unfamiliar with Pedro and Me, audience, and maybe still, I don't know, it is by Judd Winnick, who of course wrote Green Lantern for a while. He wrote Batman, and he wrote The Outsiders, but he also has wrote the Hilo Young Readers series. Well, he was a member of the cast of the third season of MTV's The Real World, which was San Francisco. And this aired in the spring and summer of 1984. And Judd, this was Judd, Pam, who he is now married to, Muhammad Puck. Puck was the person who really broke out in the big negative way. Puck was really one of the first reality show villains to ever come out. There is the one woman, she is Latina, and she is now married to a guy from Rural Rules named Sean, and she lives in Wisconsin. She was conservative because they go to CPAC or something at one point. I can't remember who the other was, but one of them was Pedro Zamora. And Pedro Zamora was Cuban American. He was openly gay and he had AIDS. And this season of The Real World, for my part of Generation X, is seminal. It is inarguably the best season of that show. I will die on that hill. It is the best season ever of The Real World. And the reason is because it explores all these people. Pedro gets married halfway through to his fiance Sean, who passed away a number of years ago as well. But the thing that was very, very sad about it is that Pedro passed. Pedro was dying, because this was the early to mid 90s. This was AIDS. AIDS now, I see commercials on TV for drugs that can help you.
Yes.
That are treat HIV and AIDS like a chronic condition. Whereas I'm floored because 30 years ago, you were positive. It was just a ticking clock at that point. And mm-hmm. Pedro was like, they would constantly monitor his T cell count and everything. And he was an activist. He would go and educate, and he was never letting on how sick he was. And he actually died like the night his final episode, the final episode of the show aired. So Pedro means the entire biography of that. Now that's, if you want to talk about media, people, portrayals of gay characters or people in media and gay media. So I go back and I'm not ragging on you for being younger than me, but I am like about 10 years, 11 years older than you. Yeah. So I lived through the 80s, and my first images were of, you know, I saw coverage of AIDS in the news, but my first images of gay people were not positive, at least in terms of the way you would see media portraying gay people today, because they were usually very effeminate, caricaturish men like mm-hmm. G and Rip Taylor, Charles Nelson Reilly, who was on the Match Game, the legendary panelist Charles Nelson, Paul Lynde, like these very flamboyant characters and things. Harvey Fierstein, I think, was the first openly gay actor I knew of, who was not flamboyant in the way, but did have an effeminate voice. But then you get to movies like The Birdcage.
Oh, sure.
But then, because I wrote like a whole list, just from off the top of my head. Of course, we talked about this two episodes ago, and I'm really not trying to be offensive, but you know how much lesbian porn I saw when I was a teenager. But I mean, that was part of it. Like, so you had, it was, and it's weird. It's a whole other discussion to have, like, men and certain types of pornography. But then you get to Pedro Zamora, and the other character who I think was very, very enlightening and really helped knock down a lot of what you had seen gay men portrayed at was Ricky Vasquez on My So-Called Life, played by Wilson Cruz, who wore eyeliner and was dressed stylishly and at the World Happiness Dance, dances to Hadaway, that's amazing, but has this struggle because he's getting abused at home, and he ends up homeless at one point, and he's struggling with his own identity, and he doesn't really come out to anybody until the end of the show, when everybody's like, oh, he's bi and he wears eyeliner and he's kind of the gay best friend, but he's not admitting it. And he finally admits it at the end. And I remember talking to somebody on my podcast about this, and he was saying who is gay. And he was talking about like that character's impact. And he was saying how realistic it was because the person I was talking to said, yeah, it was like, yeah, I kind of stumbled out of the closet as well. You know, I didn't come out all here I am. It was just kind of, and the scene where he says he's gay to Delia Fisher, he asks her out. Because the whole show, he's been at one point, like he's been trying, struggling to be normal, right? He dresses up as Brian Krakow for Halloween, for crying out loud. And she says, yes, but she goes, but you're gay, right? And he finally is just like, admits, yes, I am. And he's like, you're the first person I ever told that to. And he's been living at that point with his English teacher, who is also gay. So like you have very positive portrayals of gay characters on a teen show in the 90s where that was not done. And My So-Called Life is like one of my favorite television shows of all time. So I'm going to wax that car. Going further in, it shows like when Chasing Amy is another movie that I actually think is Kevin Smith's best movie. And there's a whole other discussion to have there. I am really, really waiting for the documentary called Chasing Amy, directed by Sav Rogers, to come out, because it is Sav's journey from transitioning. Sav Rogers is a trans male, and it is his journey from discovering Chasing Amy before he had transitioned through this, and how closely he identifies with the movie and an exploration of the movie. And I've seen so many trailers and following the news. It's on the festival circuit. I'm like, when is this going to come to streaming? So I think that's a really important movie as well. And then, but the other thing is like transgender characters. Once again, when I was younger, the word transgender was not usually said. Actually, you had transsexual. And I'm not trying to use offensive language here, but like transvestite was the other word you heard. And you heard a very shortened form of that, which was used as an insult along with the F word, right? But you had trans characters in media where the fact that they were trans was revealed for dramatic or joking effect. In Risky Business, they hire a prostitute and the prostitute ends up being a guy dressed as a woman. Like, it means a trans, you know, and that's supposed to be a joke in the movie. Or there's The Crying Game, for instance, which was like the Best Picture winner, I think, in 1992. And the big reveal, like the big huge secret, was that Jay Davidson's character through the entire movie is supposedly a woman, and the big reveal is the fact that he's a man. They were never really portrayed as anything except abnormal or as a gag. I think this is one of the things that we're getting to, like, where our culture has been struggling with this because of the way we have seen it for years and years and years. So it's taken a very, very long time, you know. And of course, you know, I have come from a family that's fairly conservative, so these were never things that were ever really talked about either. Ironically, despite my proximity to Fire Island, you know, so it's interesting to see how well culture has and how far culture has come since the 1980s.
Wow. I'm just floored that you like Chasing Amy.
Chasing Amy is one of the best explorations of how toxic masculinity comes about that I have ever seen on film.
I couldn't even make it through.
Ben Affleck's character is the perfectly written, dumb, toxic male who is trying to be a good person, but totally does not get it. And Smith writes that character so well. And I think that's one of the rewarding things about that movie, because it shows, it's essentially like, it shows you as a man what you shouldn't be doing, mm-hmm. you know, and all the things in there, like he doesn't get anything in the end. And it's because of, and he does it all to himself. And that's what I love about the movie. This is a tangent, so I'll bring us back around. But yeah, it's a whole, I've seen that movie a number of times. I have a copy. I still have my VHS copy. So,
wow.
But I think, you know, it's Smith's best written movie. Now, it's not my favorite Smith movie. My favorite Smith movie is Clerks, but that's a whole other thing.
It's a whole other show, a whole other podcast. Yeah, I don't know. I just didn't like it. And I thought to myself, I don't need to keep suffering through this. And so I turned it off. As for me, let's see, I did know Perks of Being a Wallflower and XXXHolic, though I did not remember there being queer subtext in there when I watched it my second or third year of college, so maybe I'd have to revisit that, or there was just Innocent Stella and I just didn't know, or I blocked it out, I don't even know. But I did watch that anime. As for queer representation, I remember the OC. Actually, there's a joke about on the OC where Marissa is talking to Rachel Bilson's character and saying, do you remember that movie where of the two gay guys on the mountain? And then Rachel Bilson's character goes, The Lord of the Rings? Which always cracks me up because everybody thinks that it's Brokeback Mountain,
right?
Yes. But I remember Jason Sudeikis' ex-wife. Can't remember her name.
Olivia Wilde.
Oh, Wilde, yes. She comes in and she's like a bi, interesting character. All these guys and girls like her. And then she and Misha Barton's character end up hooking up. So that was like, that's a weird thing. I'm actually rewatching for the first time since it aired One Tree Hill. Mm. And a character came out. I'm like, oh, I remember this. And like her being, it was just like poor representations in my opinion, but like trying to do it, but in a very 2000s way. And I think maybe Pretty Little Liars was like the best as I was like getting older, with M being queer and just like gay and what, mm-hmm. what that meant for her. And that I felt like the first show that I had watched that it was good representation. And now just I feel like getting better and better, and now adding more, you know, having trans rep, like Dreamer, for instance, in Supergirl. And Sabrina, one of Sabrina's friends, kind of was on a genderqueer journey as well. So it's gotten much better. I feel like when I was, you know, a teenager, a lot of this stuff was tantalizing rather than heartfelt. And so I was very much turned off by it because it's just like you're making these two girls make out because you're like trying to get an arousement out of people.
Like the Cruel Intentions scene.
Yes, absolutely. Like even that scene, I actually really like that movie, but that scene I like fast forward or I don't watch it because it does kind of like make me ill because I'm just like, this is not,
It's a clunky scene too.
Yeah. But then, you know, you get like these beautiful pictures like Portrait of a Lady on Fire and it's like, okay, that's what we're looking for. Like the emotional beat as well as, yeah, there's eroticism or intimacy there. So I feel like we've gotten better rather than just having two girls make out at a party and be like, whoa, aren't we cool? Yeah. And yeah, we don't really make gay jokes anymore. You know, we talked about this on the Friend special we did. You know, people don't really say that unless they mean it. When they say it now, they really mean it. Whereas before it was like a passing joke.
Yeah. Well, actually Friends, I forgot to mention because one of the running gags on Friends was Chandler's father, right? Was transgender, and then they had Kathleen Turner play her toward the end when he was marrying Monica, and there were a number of transphobic jokes on Friends over the years.
Well, we can move on. I was interested in Maya talking about that figure skater. That's someone.
Oh,
that
Johnny Weir.
Yeah, did not have time to Johnny look Weir. Up, but I was like, oh man.
Oh, Johnny Weir, character. Great skater, and he and Tara Lipinski do the color commentary on the figure skating on the Olympics for NBC, and they are such a great broadcasting team. I love watching Johnny and Tara do the figure skating. It's so great. Yeah.
Maybe he looks... Now, is Johnny... Is he queer?
Oh, yeah. I don't know the timeline. I don't know if he was out before Brian Boitano, because his career was after Brian Boitano's, but I don't think Brian Boitano was publicly out. Gotcha. For a while. So I don't know, but he is one of the first. I don't think Boitano was out when he was competing. I think Johnny Weir was, and this like okay. He is one of like Boitano Orser and Brian Boitano Brian Orser are both gay. The other person that I forgot to mention again, an Olympic athlete who is gay, who had AIDS, and I believe he's still alive, was Greg Louganis.
Oh,
you know, and that was that story broke, I think in the early 90s. I remember him on Oprah.
Oh boy.
So. Yeah, oh, we could go down this. This is a rabbit hole. So I think we need to pull ourselves out of this rabbit.
Tom knows a lot about figure skating. So
I love figure skating. I watch it like we watch it every time the Olympics roll around. We're watching the figure skating. I've been watching it for like 30, 40 years at this point.
Yeah.
So
how do you feel fan fiction shaped Maya's identity and sense of connection?
I think it gave her something to explore what she was trying to figure out and who she was in a way that was very safe and very fun. I thought it was kind of cool how E was able to like really get into it and create a lot of different things and explore a lot of different worlds. And you could see a lot of joy and comfort in that. And I liked how it was portrayed as this really positive thing that was a community that was built, as opposed to a bunch of weird nerds on the internet writing porn about the guys in Supernatural or something, right? because there's always those people who are like, you know, who stigmatize that sort of thing. And I'm like, no, this is, you know, it's never something I'd write, but I'm like, no, this was cool. It was cool to see that. And I thought it was one of those things that this is a creative outlet for me. And it is really, really presented in a positive way because I think he seems to be showing your audience that like there are avenues into this that you find unexpectedly, because it didn't seem like he was expecting to find this the way that they did, you know,
fan fiction or writing, the
exploration and the tying of the fan fiction and the writing to air gender, I don't think that was what they were, that A, were expecting to do. I think they were expecting just kind of like, oh, I'm going to write fan fiction. This is going to be really fun because they make a lot of friends and everything. It's really, you know, and you and I have both been around the internet a lot to see a lot of those things and possibly read some of it. And we remember the Tumblr era before Tumblr completely bricked.
Oh, archive of our own, some Nightwing Oracle. Rated R fanfic. Yeah, I like how multifaceted it was. Not only creating a community for him, but also, as you said, doing this outside research, which is going on a date, because I guess with the One Direction stuff, he was really writing some like traumatic, these scenes of angst and all of this, and then was like, oh, I'm at the end. I guess we have to have them together. And then ended up reaching out to a friend and asking her to write. And it was funny because a friend already had like thousands of words written on the scene. So, yeah, there is a lot going on there. And, of course, writing in general. I think this pushed that particular avenue for M as well. So I enjoyed those scenes.
Yeah.
One Direction, that was funny. Of all the fan fictions that E was going to be die hard on, that was not one that I would have picked.
I have a couple of friends who are on Tumblr, like, again, big on Tumblr back in the day, and 1D was one of those things that was like all over the place for them. And these are people who were, in some cases, they were older than I am. I can't explain it because I was just never a fan. I'm just kind of like, okay, interesting. It's a boy band thing.
Yeah.
I think some of the attention to the One Direction stuff moved on to K-pop eventually. But yeah, it was like they were huge in the Tumblr era in a way that like the New Kids were huge when I was in late elementary, junior high school.
Oh, One Direction. Yeah, that was, they were all the rage when I was teaching. So
yeah.
Them and Justin Bieber.
All the Justin Bieber folders that I used to see.
Oh my gosh. Well, this is required reading, and that means we talk about menstruation on this show, so of course we're going to talk about it now. When I got to that page, I was like, oh boy, we're going to talk about it.
Yay.
So, what was it like for you to read about Maya's experience with menstruation? And, this question says, how did it make you feel? And I'd also kind of like to pair it with the gynecological exam scenes.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah, just because really these two moments very much point to the assigned female at birth status of Maya. Yeah, so with the gynecological scenes as well as maybe the sex education scenes too, do you feel like they could have been better in any way to better serve M as a person? And this is almost like a thought experience because we know that these things happen. So how can we fix our healthcare?
Right. Oh, God. Yeah. How long do we have to record tonight?
Yeah, I know. Seriously.
With the sex education, I was actually pretty impressed by how good it was compared to some of this crap that I've seen in our state of Virginia. You know, the first schools I was teaching at was all abstinence only. It was very purity culture, that sort of thing, promise pledges and all that sort of thing. Like, you know, when AR describing the 3 or 4 years of sex ed they get, it's like there's a panel of the banana on the condom demonstration. There's somebody talking about STDs, which is very similar to what I experienced, which, like I said, part of my generation, we were scared out of having sex because it's like, yeah, you're going to die. And then there was the thing about your feelings. So it was really more kind of, it wasn't perfect, but I was like, wow, it was pretty impressive how progressive the sex education they got was. The scene where they get their period for the first time, again, I can't relate to this, but it seemed realistic, like in this, in the sort of like, well, what is happening to me? But I was a little surprised that A had no idea what the period was, and that like, and then when things like got going over the years, that like, there's that one panel where A discuss how like long they would keep a pad in.
Yeah.
And it was like, I think they described it as like the blood was like caked and brittle. It was like coffee grounds.
Yep.
And I'm thinking to myself, you have a very good relationship with your mother, right? Like, this is a it's not like he couldn't talk to her mother about anything, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of very deep conversations. It was just, and I, on some level, I know why I never said anything, because later you do have the gynecological exam, and we really don't know how much her mother knows about the gyno exam.
Well, this is the third one.
Yeah, the third one.
Why his mother came.
Yeah, but I mean, but we don't see a lot of so we don't see her mother really counseling her on how to do these things. They give her a flower necklace that they get her period. But so I was a little confused. Not by Maya, but by Maya's parents.
Mm.
And how did you not prep this person for these things?
Or Phoebe, potentially.
Or Phoebe. I'm just kind of it seemed... I have beef with Maya's parents in a couple of ways. But this is one of those things where I was just very confused. It's like... Either Maya was not showing something that actually is true and there was a lot more that they taught him, or really it seemed like they were just kind of figuring out on their own and stuff, and they never were ashamed or scared to go to her mother with the bathroom fears and the night, that's some serious psychological stuff there.
Yeah.
And it's not and so was there counseling? Was there therapy? And I'm not talking about weird transition therapy. I'm talking about I'm having dreams about waking up in pools of blood and stuff. I mean, so I was just a little confused by how that was able to develop in the way it did.
Yeah, I guess it was. I don't know. The fact that I was going to say the parenting is loosey-goosey. Maybe there aren't many discussions on those sorts of things, and so they tackle it when it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's the assumption that, if my child sees blood, then they'll come to me. And yeah, we're not talking about "Are you there, God? It's me, Margaret." excitement and fully prepared. But I remember.
And it's not Carrie reading... either.
No, it is not. Oh, yeah, yeah, because I was freaking out about it. But, well, I will say it's similar to Carrie, if only because Carrie did not have the full information,
mm-hmm.
And neither did Maya. And I guess in regards to, not really being more hygienic, I think it's all, aligned with shame and, why did this have to happen? And here's another sign of my... femaleness, and all of those psychological those dreams and nightmares wound up in that, and that's obviously fears that I would have of bleeding through in public are not like that. They're just for a different reason. But we let me tell you, the female population, I'm sure, everyone has most likely had some sort of bleed through and been embarrassed.
Yeah.
Which is why athletes should not have white shorts. We're getting there. No. It's taking a long time. Poor tennis players. My gosh. Yes. So I appreciated those scenes, but I would agree. Yeah, it is. It's hard. I think that was probably the first time that I really felt that struggle for Maya and the distress, I think, that he was going through. And then with the gynecological exams, listen, when that happened to me the first time, I too sobbed. And it's just so invasive. It is uncomfortable. Now, some people I hear like to get gynecological exams more than they like to go to the dentist. And that's great for you. But that is not everyone's experience. And the fact that Maya, that second trip, that speculum was bloody, that's just, oh man. And I feel like leading up to it, it seemed like it was going to be okay. The only thing that I knew was not is because the page before Maya says, spoiler, I think, it was worse than the first time. Mm-hmm. But, and then you turn the page and it's all like the doctor is, I think, empathetic and is, you know, listening to Maya talk about the pronouns and, her gender, gender identity. And the doctor is like, okay, I'll use the smallest one and I'll go, you know, as quickly as possible. And it's just an awful experience. So beyond that, I don't even know, like, what can be done? Because then, you know, Maya had to come back. So then the doctor gave oxycodone, which I thought, oh, dear. 5 milligrams for the pain and then some anti-anxiety medication.
Lorazepam, yeah.
Yeah, and I just don't know how else. If you have to do a medical procedure beyond empathy, I mean, what are you going to – like, it has to get done, unfortunately. So I just don't know how it could have necessarily been improved from there.
Yeah, and women, it's like – it's so tough because it's – even with gynecologists, it can be hard to find – the right person for treatment and examination who doesn't, because, you know, there are people who have horrible experiences with gynecologists because they're just not good doctors or they don't have a good bedside manner, you know, whatever. I've known people who, like, were basically told, like, totally wrong information about their own bodies from terrible gynecologists. So I totally see how this experience can be traumatic. Again, like, it would have been interesting to see any conversation she actually had with her – her mom about it.
Yeah.
Because there's, like, one point mom's like, hug, and then Maya sleeps for, like, several days or something.
Yeah.
And it's just like, did you have – like, so those are, like, what I was talking about, like, things that were left out. It was, like, it would have been interesting to see some of the conversations about these things because, you know, a hid their period for a long time in high school and avoided going to the bathroom in air high school for, like, what they said, like, a year or two. Mm-hmm. Now we both work in high schools. Those bathrooms are disgusting.
Yeah.
I could not go to the bathroom in high school if I had to go, unless I literally would strategically know which bathroom to use in my high school because it was – the bathrooms were disgusting and that was 30 years ago. So totally understand why Maya would not want to go to the bathroom in high school. But it was like, you know, again, it's just – and maybe they were scared off from saying anything because of the way her parents approached the first period, because it was like, this is wonderful, and here's your flower necklace, and the paddle is like, yeah. I couldn't see this new development as a reason to celebrate, and it's just like, there's these boxes that say acne and depression, stains on undies, sheets and PJs, bad sleep for a week, nightmares, blood management week, PMS and cramps. It's like, why would I want to celebrate this? And perhaps that's why I never really say anything.
Yeah.
So, which is kind of a bummer. Again, we can get into air parents a little later.
Yeah, sure. And I guess they were still just thinking that Maya was her daughter.
So mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it had yet to be broached. And because Maya wasn't necessarily speaking up about what Air was going through, then there wasn't, yeah. And I will say I did enjoy that or appreciate that the sex education happened in multiple rounds. So it wasn't just a one and done. And just to go on your, it was like anatomy when they were younger and then it moved on and they did talk about pleasure, which, you know, I appreciated.
Yeah.
And then also about consent. So it was well-rounded, as you said. So actually, let's talk about sexuality, I think. This is Jay, Tom.
Okay.
Air's exploration of Air's sexuality. How do you feel like, and this is where we could potentially talk about the challenging. How do you feel like it was well presented in this, especially going off of the fan fiction and how E signed up for, was it Tinder? And then I liked the breakdown of, like, these people liked me.
Yeah.
These people messaged. We had a conversation here. And then it basically whittled down to two people. One seemed like they were an alcoholic in the making. And then, and then Z, who is like a really pleasant and intriguing person with whom Maya has her first sexual encounters.
And a breakup with Z, I think, because it's, I don't know, things are moving too fast, or they get a little scared, if I remember the breakup correctly. So these are the controversial scenes, some of them anyway, when we're getting into sexuality, because Maya has a number of sexual fantasies about sometimes being a man.
Yep.
I like the dream where Ahab, where they wake up with the beard, and then like there's a version of the dream where you look in the mirror and they're already going gray. I'm like, that actually made me laugh. that was funny. I actually really thought that its portrayal of exploration of your own body through things such as masturbation and fantasy was very, very well done. Mm-hmm. Because masturbation is just something that is not talked about, even still, in a way that is positive in general in our culture. It's often used as jokes. Going back to like American Pie and that movie, or in like President Clinton's first Surgeon General nominee got tanked because it was Jocelyn Elders, I believe, and she had been on record as saying that masturbation was a healthy thing. And this was in the era of like, oh God, no, this is, you know, the guilt and shame that many young men and boys carry around masturbation is like off the charts, at least for my generation. I don't know about these days. And with Maya, it's different because it's not just digital penetration or sex toy, which they do try and don't mm-hmm. like.
Yep.
And so they explore like what they like and what their pleasure is. And it is fantasies about having a penis and grabbing themselves in a way as if they were masturbating a penis or something. And I thought that was really, really well portrayed in a way that is very positive and forward and healthy. And I think a gender curious queer person reading this would see this, and I think they would get a very, very good message about how they should not be ashamed about how they feel about their body and how they're exploring their body, because it helps you figure out what you like and it helps build your confidence and maybe get less scared about when you do have to venture out, even though Maya's relationships are like scary because they're still trying to figure out who they are. But in my mind, like, that's okay. Like, I'm always like of the advice, like, take it slow, because I'm like the least risk taking person in the world. But I'm like, you know, the fact that they were really exploring who they liked and what they liked, and there were false starts and stuff like that. I really liked that whole section. I felt it was really realistic and I felt it was very positive. And
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We kind of find out that Maya is more maybe like a cognitive or like a fantasy, like in air mind, and that's how E gets aroused.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it translates, which, so one of, there are two, I was going to say scenes, panels, that are brought forth to say that it's sexually explicit and then pedophilia. So one is a copy from an urn.
Yes.
Of Greek, pederasty, but mm-hmm. like the culture surrounding, you know, the older man and the younger man or boy.
Plato's Symposium.
Yes, correct. And so there's that, and Maya kind of envisions it. And then the other one is Maya is wearing a dildo. Mm-hmm. And previous to this, there was like some, I guess you could consider that sexting, like leading up to it. Yeah. And Z is giving Maya a blowjob. And so Maya in this, so you can like see all this happening. Mm-hmm. Maya in this moment, like looking down and everything, is thinking like, I thought that this would, like the thought of it is arousing, but the actual thing that's happening is not arousing. And So I think we've obviously considered and talked about this as well, like when there are sexually explicit scenes, you know, how necessary are. And I would say that both of these are necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to just point them out and be like, this is why we should condemn and censor this book is problematic.
Yeah.
Because it speaks to her larger journey in discovering. And you're absolutely right, like what you like and what you don't like, and that he had an idea of, I think I like this, but then in practice that does not actually work. I'm not sure. I'm still like trying to figure out, is he asexual or not, ? And even some people, like he was asking other people and they're like, no, because you'd lust after other people. And there was a funny, and then he responded like, but I don't like it, which I found amusing. You lust after people, but you don't like to do it. So I can't necessarily see what that is. So I think even though it may have been going fast, as you had said, because I know Z said, I'm developing an actual crush on you. I think he was also just uncomfortable, like, this is not necessarily what I want to have anyways, because relationships, like my friends are providing everything I need anyways, and like sexually I can get that in another avenue. So I think it was complex.
Yeah. So that's page 166 and 167. And I guess the other thing that you didn't bring up would be page 61, which involves masturbation, because it's a three panel thing about, I put a sock in my pants and I would air gripping the bulge.
Is
and
that then, called into question?
No, I'm just trying to think of what would the crazies get on, because the second is the second panel of that page is, this would involve hip thrusting while thinking of my latest gay ship. So the fan fiction ties into the exploration. This is how the fan fiction ties into it, because you can, if you're writing it and you're writing yourself as a male character, or you're writing a male character, maybe you're not writing yourself as a male character, but you're writing a male character, so you're doing it from the point of view of that person, you are exploring what it's like to be a male. Just like in the same way, like if I were to write a lesbian scene, I'd have to really get into the head of, or not even a scene from, maybe a hetero scene, but I'm writing it from the point of view of a woman, if I'm writing one of our smut novels from a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
But like, wouldn't I need to really dig into what is it like to be a woman having sex with a man? Like, you know, that sort of thing. So that, I think that helps with the exploration too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the strap-on scene, this is like that Helen Lovejoy, won't somebody think of the children BS, because I think it's a really good scene. I think the sexting on this page prior, it's air turned on and yet air embarrassed a little bit, mm-hmm. because it's just like, which is such a natural thing. It's and I like the way it's presented. This is the visual I've been picturing, but I can't feel anything. And it's just like, because rationally, you know that you put that thing on, you're not going to be able to feel it. It's all visual. But when it actually happens, I can imagine it's like, I wanted to feel it, you know, like, so the fact that it was much hotter when it was only in my imagination, that speaks to so much as far as fantasies are concerned and sex and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, it's a healthy portrayal of something. It's between two consenting adults at that point. I think Maya's in college at that point.
Yes.
It's between two consenting adults. It is an exploration of something. It is not pornographic or really explicit. It's like two panels. It's not like there's like several panels of really hardcore, you know, Larry Flint style stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, actually, I do think it's a very vital scene too. I agree with you.
Yeah.
By the way, the asexuality thing, you know, I also think that maybe Maya is dealing with the unspoken social pressure of having to put a label on oneself, like categorize yourself.
Yeah.
You know, because being able to identify with a certain group and categorize is a good thing, obviously, because you feel belonging. But I can see the flip side of that you feel like you should have a title, so to speak. Well, I am this, but yeah, you do this, but you're not this. And that's where I can see this like swirl. You're already, you know, you're already struggling with things. You're already confused. And this is just swirling even more. And so So yeah, I really appreciated seeing that in the book, because I think that really helps people who are reading this and who are very confused about who they are. Mm-hmm. And I'm not using confused in this sort of like, oh, you're just confused. I'm using it like in the literal sense, like, I don't know who I am. I'm searching for my identity, and here is somebody who did. And I think that's where the relatable thing might come in.
Yeah, very true. Who do you think is the audience that Maya had most in mind when writing this book?
Honestly, my first thought was herself, herself. But then it's adults and older adolescents, maybe. Although I've said, I think that it was not written specifically for like teenagers. It was written more of a, as like a slightly more adult book. Maybe the same audience that Alison Bechdel was writing Fun Home for. Mm. But on some level, I think I also read it for ourselves too.
Yeah, which could be in line with kind of the Virginia Woolf stream of consciousness, mm-hmm. sort of writing, if we consider it. So I can get behind that. I think that it is, I mean, obviously the question said most, but I do think it's to be a voice out there for people who are kind of in the same boat or swimming in the same river and be like, oh, I'm not alone, which is why we like representation. And I think it's also, it should also be for people like you and me, Tom, where this is not our story, mm-hmm. but we really want to learn about that so that we can support and be allies to, in particular, you know, our students, or, you know, children or anything. So yeah, I feel like it's an educational book for sure.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I mean, granted, I'm not going to walk up to a trans student in my class with the holding this and going, I know what you're going through.
Oh, that would be so cringy.
But I mean, it's, and I know this is not every, and I don't even think Maya Kovey thinks this is everybody's story. And I appreciate that about the book. It's like, it clearly is, this is my story. Yours might be different, but there are things you'll find that are common. But yeah, you're right. It's an inside, because we both have queer students, right?
Yeah.
And I have students whose names and pronouns are different than what's on the roster, et cetera. I'm always like asking, like, tell me what you want me to say. And I do it, sure. You know, and I'm supportive in the best way I possibly can be. It pains me when they tell them to use their birth name or dead name,
yeah,
with their parents. It pains me so much. And I will do it because they have asked me to do that, because they have said, I need you to do this. I'm like, I will do that because that's what you are asking me to do. I don't like dead naming you, but totally understand it. It's not, you know, but at the same time, it's just like, oh, that's painful to hear. And seeing this, it's just like, you know, there are kids out there who are going through this, and, or adults too. You know, I've known people who transitions in their 30s, you know, and it's just like, I don't know how much of this was going through your head when you beforehand, but you know, mm-hmm. at the same time, I hope that I'm getting a little bit of a window so that when I hear about, and you are never obligated to tell me the details.
Sure.
You know, there's no reason I have to know these things unless you want to share them. Mm-hmm. You are no obligation to share them, but I read this and I hope that I'm getting a window so that I can be a better ally. And these are the things that I really, really loved about the book and really appreciated about the book.
Yes.
It was the way I was getting a window into somebody who I am not like, and I really want to help and support in a way.
Absolutely. Windows, mirrors, or sliding glass
mirrors?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what literature is meant to be. The metaphors that Maya uses to describe air different experiences and as the story or as air progresses, which ones did resonated with you the most? Or if you want to go a different route, like which ones do you think were most helpful in understanding what gender is or what is, yeah.
The scale images on 120 and 121 I thought were really, really good. You know, assigned female at birth, assigned male at birth, and like, you know, how you're weighing that one against the other because you're not. And there's a, by the way, this is beautifully drawn. And there is a, even the like the page where they are talking about their first pap smear, and they have this image of them leaning over with a like a needle going through them.
That made me feel uncomfortable.
It's a really, really well drawn.
Oh, for thing. Sure, but yes.
There are some other very beautiful drawings. I can't think of anything other than that off the top of my head because I was kind of going through this and got it. Like, I didn't necessarily need the metaphors. Because it was like, you know, it was being explained to me very, very well. So I guess the metaphor of things like fan fiction and things like that were also really helpful because it did kind of, again, give you some a window in a way that was like, oh, yeah, I can totally see this. So what do you think?
Yeah, I really appreciate the metaphors of what having the wrong pronouns, in particular she, her, and hers being used towards Maya feels like. Like a tag that is scratching on the back of your neck, I think was one of them. Can't remember, there's like something else, but just like this, I don't know, this itchiness. Like it's innocuous, but it's also just like, it's annoying. And it doesn't feel right. And like, what can you do to fix that sort of thing? And so I really appreciated that. So that would be my particular answer. And then, yeah, just how Air eyes lit up when I learned about the Spivak pronouns. I really liked that.
The anime eyes.
Oh, yeah.
It's like it is very, very Steven Universe sort of look, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's the look on her face, so...
I guess unless you see anything else, I did skip a couple, but I feel like we've covered a lot, is just this Churchland neurobiological explanation of gender.
Yeah, before we get to, I guess, that and their parents and education.
Oh, okay. I skipped it because we did briefly talk about it.
Yeah, I just...
But yeah, what would you like to mention in particular?
So there's a couple of things that, like... I know I'm coming at this from somebody who grew up in the burbs, right? And didn't grow up the way Maya grew up. But, like, I was just kind of like, how do you come into school when your father's a teacher and you haven't learned anything prior to that?
Oh, I see.
And Maya caught up, right? Maya learned to read and devoured Harry Potter, and I think he has written something else about J.K. Rowling and anti-trans things that J.K. Rowling has said, and I don't know. I was trying to figure out like when this was being written and when Rowling had started like rolling that ball down the hill and having the snow get added to that snowball of the turfiness. So I don't, because I was just like, because like Maya devours Harry Potter, which like everybody did, right? So many people did. But at the same time, I'm like, it's not brought up like the J.K. Rowling stuff, because I kind of let it go because I was just like, there's so much more in this book. But the parents, I'm just like, it bugged me, because as a parent myself, I would have totally, you know, like I wanted my kid to explore what they, you know, I wanted Brett to explore what they like and try different things out. And same, but at the same time, I'm like, you know, I wanted to make sure that you were ready for school, you know, and there's a few other things that were, because there's a point where the other thing is the way that some of the way she's brought up is just not like, and I'm not a strict parent or anything, but it's like, did you parent your kids or did you just kind of let them roam free for a while on this farm or whatever you were living while you were hippies? Because her mother says you don't have to be super feminine to be a woman on page 148, right? And then this tracks back to the beginning of the book where they're introducing their family. And I'm looking for the pages where mom and dad are introduced, because it says neither of my parents were interested in enforcing gender roles. And then mom is a weaver, sewer, knitter, brewmaker, preschool handwork teacher, never wore makeup, a gardener. Very athletic. And then dad was an elementary school teacher, has a degree in physics, has long hair, has a beard, is a rock collector, was a Boy Scout. They simply weren't enforcing very strict gender roles. But they were setting gender roles, though. there are things that are feminine about our mother and are feminine and masculine about our father. But there's a freedom of, you know, we're not going to force you to be a, you know, we're not going to dress you up in pink your whole life. So I guess that's where you're coming from, but it's a little more subtle than, or nuanced than, and I think when mom says you don't have to be super feminine to be a woman, it goes back to the, you know, the statement that Maya has that we're interested in enforcing gender roles. It's like, no, they weren't interested in enforcing gender stereotypes. But there were certain, it looked like there were certain gendered things about Maya's upbringing that are kind of being hand waved here. And then I'm just like, by the time you're getting into the world, and Waldorf schools are progressive and like way less of the sort of regimented type of, you know, schools of standardized testing and all that we have for a public school. So there is a lot more freedom, but you come in and it's like, I don't know this. I don't know this. I don't know this. I'm like, okay. It frustrated me.
The reading, you know, as I was doing research, I don't recall this being said in the graphic novel, but that Maya was dyslexic.
It's not, and I also was wondering if Maya's also neurodivergent, not because of the gender dysphoria or anything, but because of the hyperfixation on certain things. And I was like, is there, you know, because the definition of autism spectrum has gotten so wide in a very positive way, because you can see different things about people. It's that we're not putting everybody who's autistic in one box and ADHD in one box or something. So I didn't, and I was wondering about that as well. But no, there's nothing about Maya being dyslexic in this.
Yeah, it was sad about the being behind on reading in particular was the thing that got to me. And I guess it was like, let us be one with nature, which I can totally get behind.
Yeah.
But also definitely having some literacy there. And then just because I know, going through my literacy courses, that it gets worse the longer it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, as they say.
Yeah.
I mean, that's literally what they do. So as the student gets older, they fall farther behind. So then I was just getting concerned, like, oh dear, what's going to happen? So I guess we should at least be thankful that Harry Potter was the thing that really pushed M to being a reader and appreciating that.
Yeah, I remember my own kid wouldn't try, and then we found out that they were afraid we'd stop reading stories to them. And once we're like, no, we'll always read stories until you don't want us to anymore. And then it's all of a sudden they were off to the races, the reading. I was just like, so it's like kids think in weird ways, right? And different ways and things like that. I was just kind of surprised that Maya wasn't critical of her parents.
Yeah.
Or her parents, sorry. More than I think anybody in their 20s would be. In that regard. Maybe it's because it all worked out in the end.
Yeah.
And Maya is not interested in having children, which that's fine. So maybe it's just not a thought that runs through her head, as opposed to, like, if you're going to have a kid, you do start to think about how your parents raised you. And eventually you're just like, what the hell were you doing when you did that? You know? And so maybe that's just why it didn't come up.
And then, I mean, she doesn't doesn't really have many interactions with other people's parents, it seems.
That's true.
I wonder if there's just no comparison, because everyone who is in that family seems to be kind of along the same wavelength.
Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah, I feel you. Anything else you want to, any other grievances you want to air before the feats of strength?
No. I think we got to everything aside from did we talk about the pronouns, the Spivak pronouns and those sorts of things
passing.
A little bit. I think I didn't get why they were uncomfortable with they, them, but maybe I missed that. So I read it like a week and a half ago. So maybe I missed something, because I have a number of non-binary students who use they, them pronouns, right?
Yeah.
I didn't entirely get why the Spivak pronouns were so, like, why the connection. It was cool to see it, but I was just like, yeah. So it, was there a reason given behind it? Or was it just, oh, this is cool. This is what I've been looking for my whole life. What was your...
I just felt like it was a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
He heard it and I was like, that's it. That's for me.
Okay.
Because I think we all have that. I mean, the first time I saw Moose, I was like, that's it. That's for me. And I've never gone back. And I was a child. I was a wee babe. So I think sometimes you just have feelings about things and you can't explain it.
Okay. No, that makes a lot of sense. I was just kind of curious. So, all right. Yeah, so the last question, which
the
was Churchland's neurobiological
explanation. Yeah, Churchill's neurobiological explanation of gender. So in maybe like 3 or 4 pages, and this was a long-distance friend of Maya's, this friend's aunt wrote this paper.
Uh-huh.
And I guess a book, really, tapping into something. I should have opened it up.
It's on pages 199 through 203.
Yes, Touching a Nerve, Self as Brain. And goes on to talk about development, basically,
mm-hmm.
and the gonads and what the gonads turn into, and female and male kind of processes and hormones and things going on in the brain and in the body and everything. So through that, Maya's like, oh, you know, it totally makes sense that I am the way I am. It was very sciencey.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely was like, oh gosh, what's going on here? But yeah, your thoughts on including that, and do you think that could this be something that we could use to advocate for rights and also be allies in advocating for people who are going through this and kind of protect them against other people? Or is it like too dense and those people won't listen to us anyways?
I was taken back to AP Bio.
Oh.
No, I actually think it is, or it's a jumping off point. Like, I was, because I think my note was, this is really interesting. I haven't spent enough time with it. I'm like, yeah. It's like I need to look up more, corroborate it, and things like that, because these are great, great points. And yet it is, because jump into a comment section about transgender athletes. Right, for instance, that's the big thing, right? That's the thing that everybody seems to be like all up in arms about. And it's never trans boys. It's always trans girls, right? Like nobody seems to be worried about a trans boy walking onto a boys cross country team and blowing everybody away. They're always, they're always bothered about the other way. But all of these pseudoscience commenters come out with these like, here, I'm going to spit these facts at you, which is like, no, you got those talking points from whatever Heritage Foundation book you were reading or whatever Andrew Tate thing you saw or whatever Fox News thing you saw. It's like, I can totally see through your scientific explanation, but fight fire with fire. This is a really good starting point to build something where it's like, no, there are biological things going on here. This is not just Alexandra saying, call me Alex and give me they, them pronouns or he pronouns. You know, this isn't because there is a lot of it. There's a really good episode of the podcast Maintenance Phase that actually goes into this and a lot of the transphobia. It's recent. It was a fairly recent episode. And it's like, you know, this weird idea out in the internet that teenagers are just choosing to do this because they think it's cool or something. Or the ones who are actually going through treatments are like being abused and like there's all this horrific stuff being said. And I'm just like, no, there's a lot going on here that you're not right now not willing to listen to. Now, the thing is, it's like, are they going to be willing to listen to you even if you hit them with science? You know, that's the frustration.
Yeah, I would hope, because research-based, you know, evidence, I think, can help with a lot of things. But it's like, are these people willing to listen? Because I know a big bugaboo, obviously this is a different topic, but just to give an example, is social emotional learning at the moment.
Uh-huh.
It's like the next one for Moms for Liberty after CRT. And so critical race theory. And I asked someone who had that as like her focus in my program, I was like, are you encountering this? And she said, sometimes, but basically like we present the evidence and then they back off. Like we show that these are the results of you know, what we're telling you to do. So ideally, yes. But I also think that what I read there would not fly with a lot of people. Like, you're going to have to dumb it down.
Oh, yeah. It's really, like, it's that's college-level academia. Oh, yeah. That's where I said I think it would help us to dive into a little bit more so that you could come out with talking points that are more layman's terms that don't overwhelm somebody or just confuse somebody, because you want them to understand.
Yes, correct. Correct. And they're, yeah, just going to get frustrated if they don't understand. And I think Maya uses direct quotes. So,
yes. Put references under the board balloons.
Yeah. Well, I think that's it. So then the question that we end is this required reading?
Yeah, definitely. The story, you know, for every quibble I have with the storytelling aspect of it, I do think this is important. I think it takes something that is, you know, obviously very topical right now, but also very real and very complicated.
Yeah.
This is very complex, and it really, it distills it and presents it in a way that isn't dumbed down, but is also very simply shown in a very good way. I really think this is a very well done book.
Yeah. And because I certainly was one of those people who was like, oh, well, if you're not female, then don't you just want to be male? But it, like, that's not what the issue
is.
Yeah. Like, it's definitely more nuanced than that. And so I really appreciate getting in there and having those people come up to Maya and ask that very same question. It's like, okay, that was me, and now I better understand. I think it's still like super complex. I think that this is obviously Maya's the answer to the question is yes, I think it's required reading. This is Maya's journey, and so someone else using these same pronouns, also, you know, gender queer, mm-hmm. is not going to have the same feelings that Maya is relating in these books. So I think, as with everything, we cannot make Maya a monolith in this regard.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a great entryway for educating ourselves, which I think is always necessary.
I would love to see other books of the same, the same type of story from other people who have different backgrounds.
Yep.
Because I think if the more the black genderqueer person or Latinx or, you know, from another culture, or the kid in the burbs, or like from like all different places and walks of life, it would be really, really cool to see more of these stories out there, even in, especially in graphic novel format, because I think it's a great format for this. Mm-hmm. It'd be really, really cool. And I really do hope this has opened the door for that, because Scholastic picked it up. That's a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Lion Forge was a small independent press. They got bought by Oni. A few years ago, and they were just primarily publishing graphic novels. So they were like, you know, the fact that this took off the way it did to begin with is good. And then Scholastic picking up is a big deal. So I really do hope this leads to other books like this being published.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So we do have some feedback. I'm going to go ahead and read our first comment, which is from Gene Hendricks. And then Stella is going to read our Facebook comment from Robert Ward.
If I want to.
So Gene was writing in about, I believe it was episode 90. And he says, I know you have, to Stella, I know you have a bias against changing the Hades and Persephone story, but I highly recommend Lore Olympus to tackle some really rough issues such as mental and physical. And I think you'd find it fascinating, if not enjoyable, at at the very least, there's a lot of often overlooked Olympians involved in the story, and he sent us a link. Stella replied to that comment asking if it romanticized kidnapping, and he says not at all. In fact, there's a lot of trauma that is dealt with, and none of it is romanticized. It's actually treated with respect and good information if someone is reading it has had similar experiences. So if you want to, you can go over our Facebook page and find that. And you can find Gene over at the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. He does the Hammer Strikes podcast. He also does a lot of voice acting with the Akadegonagon Theater, which is the TTF audio productions of they've done Strangers in Paradise, but they've also done a lot of like public domain comics and stuff like that. So Gene's a great guy. Check him out over there. And then, of course, our Scholastic book buddy Robert Ward about episode 89 and 90.
I know you already recorded the next episode, but do yourself a favor. If you want a really fun, dirty queer story, listen to a Chuck Tingle story on Audible. Tinglers are only, are only 20 minutes long, but they are so absurd and so hilarious to hear as they are read by Georgia Bird. There is nothing as good as them. The best part, though, is that they can be genuinely sweet regardless of their meme covers and plots. Do you think you'll do that?
I don't know. You know, I haven't read a, I have not read a smut book since we had that discussion.
Yeah. Do you think you'll go back?
I might. If something looks interesting.
TBR pile, but.
Yeah. I've been working. I've had like a book club thing coming up on Friday. So I had to read two YA books for that. And of course I read this, and then I've got the next book that we're going to be reading. Maybe I'll get to some smut. So.
Okay. Well, Tom, I guess, yeah, we'll do that. Will we be reading smut next month? Who knows? Tom, what are we reading for episode 93?
Cool. I wanted to dive into a genre that we haven't done before, or a form we haven't done before. And it's the form that I think has been around for maybe a decade or so, but in the last decade or two, but in the last 5 to 10 years has become bigger.
I don't know what it is.
And I'm going to be doing a whole unit on it next year. But it's novels in verse.
Oh, yes.
So, and I've read quite a few of them. Yeah. But I was like, I really wanted to pick the one that I'm like, this is, if I was giving somebody a novel in verse, I would give them this one. And it is The Poet X.
Yes! It's so good. Okay, that's great. I don't own it, but it is on my like to buy. When I move to Maryland, I have several books that I'm waiting to buy, like the new Iliad translation, because I don't need the extra poundage. And The Poet X is one of them. So by the time we record, I will own it. I'm excited.
Cool. Yeah, I have the new Iliad translation, by the way. But yeah, no. So come back in about 30 days or so-ish for that. And as always, thank you very much for listening and take care. And before I do that, please, if you are interested in engaging us in discussion on this episode, please email us or leave a comment on Facebook or Twitter or, you know, wherever you want to find us. We would love to have more conversations about genderqueer and the issues in here, because this discussion was fascinating and very interesting, as was the book. So feel free to email us, discuss us. Come after me, whatever you want to do. So thank you very much for listening and take care.
Absolutely. And send along your favorite fan fictions, whether they're superhero related or not.
Yes. Even the Slash ones about the old school
Batman and Flash.
And Kirk and Spock. So that's the origin of it, right? All right. Anyway, good night.
It might be, yeah. Goodbye. Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreadingwithtomandstella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.